You're listening to Red Eye on Co-op Radio at CFRO 102.7 FM.
Naomi Klein, activist, journalist, and author of The Shock Doctrine, spoke in Vancouver last week. She was on stage with a panel of activists struggling for immigrant rights, justice for First Nations, and an end to poverty. We'll bring you some of those voices on a future program, but here now is Naomi Klein speaking on the connections between struggles in the face of disaster capitalism, an economic system where the interests of life, liberty, and justice are at fundamental odds with the interests of the market.
More and more of the global economy now does better the worse things get. Now, we know about the military-industrial complex. We know that weapons companies make money when there's war. But we are entering a new phase here, and we're seeing it in many ways. We're seeing it right now with the food crisis, where companies like Monsanto and Cargill are reporting staggering record profits in the midst of the crisis. We see it in the AIDS pandemic with the pharmaceutical companies making money hand over fist. We see it with the explosion of the Homeland Security complex, which is a now $200 billion global industry, more than Hollywood and the music industry combined. So it isn't just weapons. And these are the companies, you know, how do we define a company that fits within this, what I'm calling disaster capitalism complex? These are the companies that do better the worse things get, i.e. they don't have the same interests as us. You know, a terrorist attack happens, the NASDAQ goes up now, goes up. Why? Because all the Homeland Security stocks are soaring. There's a natural disaster, the stock market goes up now. Why? Because the insurance company stocks go up, because the mercenary company stocks go up, because the market is adapting. It is adapting to a new reality of constant crisis, of constant crisis. So this sort of 1990s idea of no two countries with McDonald's have ever gone to war, trade creates stability, no. This is an adaptation to what we might think of as the Israeli model or the Colombia model. These are markets, actually some of the most successful economies in the world. The Israeli economy is second only to China and India in terms of its rates of economic growth. Colombia has the highest growth rates, I believe, besides Chile and Latin America. And what Colombia shows is that you can have low-level warfare, you can get the resources out of the ground, and you can secure it with private mercenary companies, and you can make money on both ends. And actually, that's a more profitable model than the kinds of economic alternatives that are being developed in Bolivia and Ecuador, which is precisely why there's been this push to pull Bolivia and Ecuador into the so-called war on terror model with these incursions into Ecuadorian territory by the Colombian government. I actually was recently in Ecuador presenting the book and doing some research there, and I'm going to talk more about it. I was in Bolivia as well, and I was touring with a fantastic Colombian activist named Hector Mondragon, who works with the Cauca people. Some of you may know his writing. It's published a lot on CNET. He's an economist who specializes in agrarian reform, and he's also a torture survivor, and he's one of the people who really influenced the writing of the Shock Doctrine. And we spoke on many platforms together where I would, you know, sort of give the big picture thesis of the book, and then Hector would say, this is how it is being applied in a state of constant shock in Colombia, and Colombia is your future, he was saying to Bolivians, if this model is able to be imposed on your countries. I was in Calgary in September, and I mentioned this at the event I did in Vancouver, and some of you may have heard this story before, but I went to Calgary to do a talk about the Shock Doctrine, and there was all this hype before I went in the Calgary Herald. Like, there was the lead article was, Naomi Klein's a brave woman for coming to Calgary. And it was this whole thing of, like, how dare you come to the sovereign state of Alberta, you know? But the weird thing was, when I got there, the book was a bestseller. It was number one on the Calgary Herald list, which I think they tried to scratch out, but And the event that I did was sold out, a 900 seat venue. And there aren't 900 lefties in Calgary, right? So who are these people? And so I was joking, that they thought it was a how-to guide, right? And that's why they were there. They were buying the book for tips, right? How to get in early on Iran or something, right? But actually, that is not the case. And Albertans are getting sick and tired of their leadership class of disaster capitalists. But what was so interesting was the awareness in Alberta about how intimately connected their economic boom, the economic boom that they're experiencing because of the tar sands, how connected that is to global warfare and instability. Because, of course, the tar sands, the vast majority of the oil that is now being extracted from the tar wasn't counted as part of the global oil reserves before Iraq was invaded. And that's because it cost more to turn the tar into liquid than you could sell it for. It cost $25 a barrel. So it was only after the invasion of Iraq, when the price of oil climbed past 30 and then now past 130, I believe we're at, that it became economically feasible. So what happened was, you know, we say Iraq was invaded for its oil. Well, they actually haven't gotten Iraq's oil yet, although they're getting really close. But there has been an oil boom because of the invasion of Iraq, because of the threats of attack on Iran, because of the state of constant instability that sends the price of oil soaring. But the boom's in Canada. We've gotten the oil boom. So when I was addressing this audience in Calgary, I said, what is the one thing that could threaten your economic boom? And they said, peace. Because it actually changes your brain when you're living truly within the disaster capitalist economy. You can't help it, no matter who you are. You understand that the worse things get, the better things are for you. And that doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means you actually are living in the real world. So you read the newspaper differently. You can't help it. So we are deeply embedded in this economy of disaster. The fact that Canada's economy isn't in worse shape is intimately linked to that. The fact that parts of the economy are getting worse and worse because of the strength of the dollar are linked to that. Now, it's also a challenge to a lot of what we're told about conventional wisdom about climate change, which is that if the price of oil gets high enough, the market will respond and we'll have these huge infrastructure investment in sustainable energy sources like wind and solar. Well, that hasn't happened. But as Harjit was saying, there is a massive infrastructure investment going on in Alberta, massive technological investments going on to try to figure out how to more efficiently transform that tar and later the shale into liquid form. So actually, it's the opposite of what we've been told, that the high prices are creating the economic incentive to do the dirtiest form of extraction possible, and we're not investing in the other sources of energy that we might invest in. So we spent some time today, earlier today, this is we had a smaller session that was convened by Arthur Manuel about the wave of criminalization of First Nations people across Canada. And so this is the second time that Samuel and I have shared a platform. And this is also connected, the fact that we're seeing more and more standoffs, more and more arrests of First Nation leaders who are standing up to resource extraction, standing up to gentrification across the country. I think sometimes it's hard to tell whether this is just status quo or something more is happening. Something more is happening. And something more is happening for the same reason that the tar sands are exploding. Commodity prices across the board are through the roof, okay? So what that means is that, you know, we had the sort of first colonial pillage. And what was left were the most remote areas, the hardest to reach areas, the most expensive to reach areas, the most expensive to develop resources, the parts of the world where you have some of the greatest fighters among Indigenous communities who you know are going to put up a hell of a lot of resistance. Well, those parts of the world were sort of put on hold, like we'll get to you later, okay? Later is now. Later is now, because the price of all of these commodities is so high. It's oil, it's gas, it's coal, it's gold, it's everything. This is a final colonial pillage that is going on around the world, where we're seeing these resource companies with Canadian mining companies at the forefront just going in regardless and bringing mercenary companies with them to deal with the resistance. It's happening around the world. And so the fact that this event happened earlier today to discuss this criminalization process is intimately linked to the disaster capitalism economy and all of these companies that do better the worse things get. Sam said earlier today that they had thought that they were safe because they're so remote. 600 kilometers north of Thunder Bay, right? That he grew up thinking we're too far away for them to bother with us. No one is too far away for them to bother when you have the price so high. So we have to understand what we're dealing with here. In British Columbia, you have another factor, a layering on top of this, which is the Olympics. So you have the resource hunger of the commodity boom, and on top of that, you have the land hunger of the Olympics, linked to skiing, linked to gentrification. And so that is the context. I want to pick up a little bit on what Khalid was talking about fear and profiled communities. It reminded me of a conversation I had early on when I was researching this book with a man named Federico Alodi, who's the founder of the Center for the Victims of Torture in Toronto, is the first such center. Now there are many around the world. We were talking about Guantanamo, and he said to me, well, you know, torture is always public. And he just sort of said it casually, as if it was something that everybody understood. But I had never really thought about it before, because I always thought of it as something that states try to hide, right? That an investigative journalist intrepidly uncover the fact that torture is happening. But the truth is that torture, in order for it to be effective, always needs to be semi-public. We always need to sort of know about it. And we understand that if we think about other countries, right? If we understand it, if we think about Latin American countries that disappeared their citizens, and they did it in this quasi-public way, because of course it was a warning. It was not just a targeting of the individual who was being thrown into a car and sped off to a torture center. It was a warning to the whole community who saw it. They said, this is what's happened. The message was, as a form of communication, this is what happens to you if you step out of line. And I think we are in denial, so many of us, about the fact that we are being communicated with. We're being communicated with in the threat of deportations, in the threat of becoming a terrorist suspect or a sleeper cell. Some communities understand this very, very well. But I think all of us need to understand that these tactics, which are understood everywhere else in the world as tactics of state terror, not mere human rights abuses, are being practiced on the most marginal communities in Canada by our government. Now, I want to talk a little bit about this shift that the Israeli state went through when they realized that they didn't need peace to have prosperity. They needed security. This was a dramatic change in discussion, in language, and I think it's interesting because of the language being used around the security and prosperity partnership. It isn't about peace. It isn't about justice, it's about security and prosperity. And the Israeli business community in the early 1990s actually started lobbying for some sort of a peace accord with the Palestinians, which is ultimately what led to the deeply, deeply flawed Oslo Accords. But actually that happened because the Israeli business community saw globalization happening. This is the early 90s, you know, post-89. And felt themselves isolated from this economic boom. And there was this slogan of prosperity through peace that took hold, or a business peace was another phrase that was used. Now, what the Israeli business community talks about is prosperity through security. Peace is not necessary. What's needed is the ability to secure the perimeter. But more than that, the Israeli economy has adapted to this reality of constant warfare and found ways to profit from it. And one of the ways that the Israeli state profits from it has been by privatizing much of the response to the occupation, much of the occupation itself, the infrastructure, and then turning Israel into a kind of a showroom for a effective sort of green zone country, a country that can exist with war all around, but provide security for its citizens. And you know, this is one of the sort of more controversial parts of the book, is looking at how Israel has marketed itself to countries like Canada, the US, European countries, running all kinds of extensive tours for our police, borders, politicians to come to Israel and see how you can have prosperity without peace, but with security. And the selling of all of this expertise in border control, checkpoints, CCTV cameras, and so on. One of the things that I'm trying to challenge these days is some of the discourse around, you know, the war in Iraq being a failure, the war in Iraq being a disaster. You know, obviously it's a disaster for Iraqis. More than a million Iraqis have died. It's a disaster for U.S. taxpayers. It's a disaster for U.S. soldiers. But it is not a disaster for everyone. The occupation of Iraq has really turned that country into a laboratory for privatized warfare and occupation. And what we see is that the longer the occupation wears on, the more privatized it becomes, and the more it becomes this laboratory for all of these private security companies to take on functions that they never have had before or not for many years, like prisoner interrogation or the complete running of the green zone in the case of Halliburton, which is really sort of like a city state for Halliburton. What the stage we're at now is that all these companies that got a taste of a kind of a corporate rule in Iraq, and right now in Iraq there are 180,000 private contractors and only 160,000 foreign soldiers. So there are more private contractors than there are soldiers. And this has a knock-on effect, because in all of the other war zones, like Afghanistan, Colombia, the line is, well, we don't have enough soldiers, so we need to fill it in with mercenaries. And Blackwater has been going around saying, let us into Darfur. They want to, you know, they're saying the UN can't do it, we'll do it. So all these companies that got a taste of this in Iraq are now looking to diversify. They're not sure how long this is going to last, but they're looking to diversify. And I think it's really important for us to look at where they see their growth industries, okay? Blackwater is a particularly interesting company to look at because it's so telling. I mean, they see three growth areas, and it's always important to remember that Eric Prince, the CEO of Blackwater, said that he wanted to do for the U.S. military what FedEx did for the post office, okay? He sees himself as fully within the neoliberal paradigm, but taking it to its final frontier, okay? And he sees three areas: genocide prevention, okay, in Darfur, disaster response to natural disasters, i.e. responding to the increasing numbers of disasters as a result of global warming, and border control. Okay, they have just opened a new base 3 miles from the border with Mexico. There was a huge fight about it because the community that they were supposed to open up in, called Potrero near San Diego, kicked them out. They found another community and they've opened up because they have said that they see the border as a major new industry. Halliburton got a major contract to build prisons for in the case of a sudden influx of refugees. Okay, now this is all connected because, of course, we have an economic model that constantly produces disasters and crises, which constantly produce mass migration, whether it's NAFTA, whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's a war. So there's now the ability to profit from those disasters and also to profit from containing the people who move in the cases of those disasters, and also to profit from saving the wealthy, saving the elites, from the living with the effects of these disasters. So there's, for instance, some of you have heard me talk about this before, a private company that was launched a year after Hurricane Katrina in Florida called HelpJet. And HelpJet is a charter airline whose slogan is that we'll turn your hurricane into a luxury vacation. And they work on the country club model, where you pay an annual fee, and if a hurricane is coming to your part of coastal Florida, they will let you know, and they will arrange for you to get out of the hurricane zone, take you to the private airport terminal, whisk you off to the resort of your choice, to the five-star resort of your choice. Now, we are literally getting into this kind of a phase, and during the wildfires in California last summer, we saw something that we hadn't seen in more than 100 years, which is private firefighters showed up in the wealthiest areas working for the insurance giant AIG. If you lived in the wealthiest areas that were hit by the forest fires, you paid extra on your insurance premium, and as part of being a VIP member, your home was sprayed down with this white foam sort of fire retardant, and your home was protected and your neighbor's was not. Now, everyone was shocked by this. In the 8 months since then, 5 of AIG's competitors have announced that they too, and Wildfire season is coming, and this year there will be 5 more insurance companies offering VIP private firefighting protection. Okay? So this is the way the market is responding to global warming. Do we get it? Okay? Not with solar and wind, not with moving to green energy and sustainable living, but actually by reenacting the rapture on Earth. Okay? And it is a huge industry. And we have to understand that we are not all in this together, okay? This is something that was also said this morning, that we were talking about the similarities with the biblical myths of escape. You know, the boat's coming, you and your friends can get on, everyone else can drown. You know, there's a big elevator in the sky coming to take you and your friends. And one of the speakers earlier today said, you know, only the rich can afford to press eject. And so I think there's a lot of naivete sometimes in our environmental discourse, where it's sort of like, you know, at least even Dick Cheney has grandkids, you know, we just have to hold hands, we're all in it together, raise awareness. You know, Dick Cheney's going to Dubai. We need to understand this with his grandkids. And the other area that, we see the growth areas. Responding to global warming. By the way, Monsanto has been buying up hundreds of patents on what they call climate-ready seeds, seeds that are resistant to the effects of global warming, salination, drought. And this VIP disaster rescue and containing and surveilling the disposed of people, the displaced people, the migrating people. All of this is the new face of neoliberalism. With the Olympics coming, we have to understand that the Olympics increasingly are the state of emergency, state of exception, that creates the leap forward for the imposition of this privatized security state. I just came back from China, or I was in China in March for several weeks researching a big piece about how the Pearl River Delta is now this laboratory. It's the new frontier for the homeland security industry. Now, in China, they're projecting a $33 billion industry in CCTV cameras, facial recognition software, biometric IDs. It's all the big players, Honeywell, IBM, GE, the company that takes your picture at the US border and fingerprints, it's called L1, they're in there too. All of these American companies are rushing in. And the Olympics is what has unleashed all of this, because after the Tiananmen Square massacre, it actually was illegal for American companies and Canadian companies too to sell equipment that could be used for repressive purposes in China by the Chinese police. But now it's going in the name of Olympic security. And there's a security arms race going on around the Olympics. And just to put this in perspective, after September 11th, the first country to have the games, very shortly after September 11th, was Greece, the Athens Games. And they spent an unprecedented amount on security because there was such a heightened awareness and fear at that point. They spent $1.5 billion on security, okay? China is spending $13.4 on Olympic security. All of the equipment is staying, okay? By the time it's 2010, the standard will now be Beijing, okay? And this is what we have to prepare for. So, is there another way of responding to our crises beyond containing the poor and saving the rich? As I mentioned, I was recently in Ecuador, and of course, part of this model of profiting off of climate change is the Kyoto model. It's carbon trading, carbon credits, marketizing pollution. Well, in Ecuador, they're developing another model. And just to put this in a little bit of context, well, as you know, Ecuador is one of the governments, one of the countries in Latin America that has recently elected a left-wing government led by Rafael Correa. Interesting guy, lefty economist. I like him because one of the first things he said when he came to power, he was asked, well, what can we expect from your economic policies? And he said, let's put it this way, I'm no fan of Milton Friedman's. And then he announced that he planned to close the military base in Manta, Ecuador, which is the largest military base, U.S. military base in Latin America. And he said the only way that he would keep it open past its lease expiry date in 2009 was if Ecuador was allowed to open a military base in Miami. So it's closing. You know, he comes from a classic, what in Latin America is called a developmentalist economic tradition. And before he became president, he was a finance minister for a time and was at war with the World Bank because there is a pipeline that's going through the Amazon. And Rafael Correa, and it's being funded largely by the World Bank, Rafael Correa wanted there to be a clause in the agreement that 20% of the profits from the pipeline would go to healthcare and education. Okay? And he was told, no way. And that's why he's also been at war with the World Bank since he's come to power, and they kicked out the official, and he accused them of extortion, and so on. So, you know, on the surface, that's a really progressive position. And the problem that Rafael Correa faces is that indigenous people in Ecuador don't want the pipeline at all. They want the oil to stay in the ground. And there's a huge leave it in the ground movement in Ecuador because this is going through the Yasuni National Park, which is a part of the Amazon that has more species in 1 hectare than in all of North America, incredibly biologically rich. And the pipeline represents the end of ways of life for indigenous people in that area. And Ecuador has the largest and strongest indigenous federation in, I believe, the world. It's called CONAI. And they have come into very strong conflict with Correa for their leave it in the ground position. And they've come up with a compromise. And the compromise is called ecological debt. And what ecological debt means is that we should pay Ecuador to leave it in the ground. Because why should Ecuador pay the costs for global warming? Why should they not develop the resources that they have when they have been through more than 500 years of exploitative extraction and have not contributed in any major way to the emissions that have led to global warming? And so they've come up with this model and have proposed it on the international stage. So far, they haven't gotten much traction. But their deadline, and I think we should be thinking about this, is in 1.5 years, there's a meeting in Copenhagen to come up with the post-Kyoto consensus. And I think the real danger is that the post-Kyoto consensus will be all more of this market-based solutions to global warming. What we can do by talking about ecological debt is really shift the discussion. It questions who is a creditor and who is a debtor. It flips it on its head. It says Ecuador doesn't owe us, we owe Ecuador. And it also raises the question of, what does it mean, who should pay, and how should we pay? And then we might be starting to talk about some of the outrageous profits being made by the oil giants. Every single quarter, it's a new record. I believe Shell's last quarter was $8 billion in clear profits. And then we could think about what this paradigm might look like in Alberta. And we also might think about what our ecological debt is to First Nations people in this country. Because, of course, we owe an enormous ecological debt. What's interesting about thinking about ecological debt in Canada, and in BC in particular, is that there is such a powerful legal basis for arguing these points. I want to quote, actually, something that Arthur Manuel today was talking about his father, George Manuel, who is one of the greatest First Nations leaders Canada has ever had. And Arthur, if you'll forgive me, I think what you said your father said was, we never signed nothing, that's how come you can do what we do. The point is, of course, that much of British Columbia is unceded First Nations land. And that represents a tremendous, hard-won victory. It's not just that they didn't get around to it. Now, there was an article recently by the head, I believe, of the British Columbia Chamber of Commerce in the Vancouver Sun, talking about how the biggest problem that the business community in British Columbia faces is the lack of certainty. The lack of certainty. That in order to do business in this province, there needs to be much more certainty around First Nations land claims. And that this should be the major priority of this government, to get certainty, otherwise known as extinguishment. Now, I think it's really worth thinking, pausing and thinking about that paradigm. Because what would British Columbia look like if there was more certainty than there is right now? Now, how many more mines, clear cuts, subdivisions, ski hills, would there be in this province if there was the certainty that the Chamber of Commerce is looking for? And is this lack of business certainty actually the priority for this province, or is it the depletion of the salmon stocks? Is it the outrageous inequality and homelessness in this amazingly rich city? So I think we need to really be proud of that uncertainty and be very grateful for the remarkable, heroic achievement that is behind that uncertainty, because it creates a legal basis to make claims and for Canada to be working in coalition with these movements in South America and around the world. Because what we see is, this is not a First Nations issue, this is a planetary survival issue. And what we have potentially is another paradigm that is not about pressing eject, that is not about escaping the mess that we create and saving us and our friends, but is based on a completely different model, which understands that the Earth's resources are finite, that we live with the mess that we create, that we cannot escape from it. There's no elevator taking us to the sky, no boats coming, at least not for all of us. And I just want to bring in one other voice, which is Sean Brandt, who's an amazing First Nations activist in Ontario, who's in jail right now. I believe he had a trial date today. I met Sean I've known him for years. He's an anti-poverty activist in Toronto and First Nations activist in Tandanega. And he sort of came to national fame over this occupation of a quarry. It was very symbolic because they were negotiating over the terms of the settlement. It was agreed that this was Tandanega territory, but they were negotiating the terms of the settlement. And while they were negotiating, the land was literally being carted away in these huge dump trucks. So this is actually what happens with the endless negotiations, but here it was just so visual. So they said, no, you can't negotiate for the land while you're taking the land away. So they went to the quarry and they occupied it. And it was interesting. This was last summer, and it was the time when the Harper government was suddenly having to have seemingly progressive issues on climate change. And they had really changed their whole line on the green issue. And what Sean was saying was, why can the environment be a national issue, but First Nations rights can't be a national issue? Why is it that on this one issue, we somehow trust the experts, trust the politicians and the leaders to sequester themselves in hotels and come up with a solution and hand it down, where when it's any other issue, any human rights issue, war, climate change, AIDS, we understand that we actually need to organize for the change that we want and build movements. And I think that the Olympics 2010, this landmark, represents an incredible opportunity for all of us to build broad-based coalitions and recapture some of the urgency and some of the courage that we had shocked out of us by September 11th. And, our government invited the world's attention to come to British Columbia. They said, come, we want to show off. We want to show you who we are. That is an amazing opportunity for all of us, and I hope we use it. Thank you.
You've been listening to Naomi Klein speaking in Vancouver last week.